Okay, we are going through Parshat Mishpatim. We had an interesting discussion last time about the issue of abortion, the issue of the rights of the fetus. And at the end of that passage, the talk talks about two men fighting with each other and a pregnant woman getting pushed and losing her child or giving birth to her child. We talked about all the different possibilities of interpreting that text. At the end of that text, we have yet another controversial text that we will spend all of today talking about, and perhaps the next session we'll still have some more to say about
Ayin tachat ayin, an eye for an eye. Just
to remind ourselves about the verses. The verses say, but if other damage ensues, whatever that means, that's what we talked about last week. But the standard Jewish understanding is that it means if the mother dies from having been pushed, then the penalty shall be
nefesh tachat nafesh, ayin tachat ayin, shein tachat shein, yad tachat yad, regel
tachat ragel, kviya tachat kviya, petza tachat patza, chabura tachat chabura. Life for life, eye for eye, etc. You can read the list on its on your own. What does the pshat of this verse mean? And what did the Jewish interpreters do with this verse over the years? Well, first of all, let's take a look what it says in the Code of Hammurabi. As we've said before, and as we will say in future sessions, there are quite a few elements of overlap between the laws of Hammurabi and the laws of Eshnunna, two law codes from the ancient Near East that are many years before Moshe Rabbeinu. We see various traces of some of these laws in the Torah. In the beginning, when the codes of Hammurabi and Eshnunna were first discovered, scholars said, oh, take a look at how similar these are. This is really significant. And as years went on, people started paying more attention to the differences between Hammurabi and Eshnunna on one side and the laws of the Torah on another side. So in the laws of Hammurabi, we find, if a man knock out the teeth of his equal, his teeth shall be knocked out.
If he knock out the teeth of
a freed man, that means somebody who was a slave and then was freed, then he shall pay one third of a gold mina. And if anyone strike the body of a man higher in rank than he shall receive 60 blows with an ox whip in public. So this is very standard in Hammurabi, that the punishment depends on the status of the person who is committing the crime and the status of the victim. And so we have different penalties. We saw this last week also when what Hammurabi had to say about causing a miscarriage. It depended on the status of the woman who had this miscarriage or who was injured some man. And so this continues here. But we do find in paragraph 200 in the Code of Hammurabi, if a man knock out the teeth of his equal, his teeth shall be knocked out. And presumably, in the Code of Hammurabi, this means literally, his teeth shall be knocked out. I don't know if anybody who suggested that actually is just a phrase. And so, from when we find that the Bible says, ayin tachat ayin,
shein tachat shein,
is it trying to say the same thing on the pshat level? We will have more to say about this as this session goes on. Rashi presents to us the standard Jewish understanding.
Ayin tachat ayin, a person who blinds the eye of someone else must
pay the victim the value of the eye. And what is the value of the eye? In other words, paying the amount that his value would be diminished if sold as a slave in the market. In the same way, all other cases are to be dealt with, but it does not mean actually cutting off the offender's limb, as our rabbis explained in the Talmud.
Rashi sends us to Perek
HaHubel and Bava Kama, where there's a very long discussion, and in which it's totally clear there is only one opinion there in the Gemara. The discussion goes on for pages of trying to prove from the text that that ayin tachat ayin means money. It does not mean an eye for an eye. It means that if trying to figure out the value of an eye, then we would see if I were the person who lost an eye, we would find out how much
I would get on the slave market
if they were to try to sell me as a two-eyed person, and if compared to what my value would be as a slave if they were selling me as a one-eyed
person. And that's the way
to figure out what the financial value of an eye is. So this is the
standard halachic position,
found in Jewish texts. The question is that we will see today that many of the commentators try to deal with the question of, you know, like, how did we get there? So here's what Ramban says a couple of generations after Rashi. It is well known that the rabbinic tradition teaches that this means money. The same language is used in the Torah in context that must be interpreted as referring to money, such as the verse, Umakev nefesh behema yeshavena nefesh
tachat nafesh. Whoever
kills an animal, yeshavena, shall make recompense nefesh tachat nafesh.
Now,
no one would suggest that nefesh tachat
nafesh means here
that if I kill your dog, that I will be killed, or that my dog will be killed. It's like unthinkable to say this. In the continuation of that passage, it says, that there's a monetary penalty if it is an animal. And so we see that the phrase nefesh tachat nafesh
can be used.
I think this is a strong argument. I'm not saying it's a convincing argument that finishes the discussion, but it does put some doubt into your mind that when you see the phrase ex tachat ex,
does that necessarily
mean what it says, ayin tachat ayin? Does that really mean an eye for an eye in the literal sense that if you take out the eye of somebody else, that your eye will be taken out? So we see here that nefesh tachat nefesh just means give recompense to the value of that life.
That's Ramban's
first textual argument for the
standard rabbinic tradition.
Ramban goes on to Amar Rabbi Abraham. Even as Ezra
commented that the implication of the language of
Scripture is that he really is deserving of such a punishment that his eye be taken from him if he does not pay a ransom.
In other words, Ibn Ezra's argument, and many other
commentators have made this argument, but what the text is actually trying to say is this is what you deserve. Not that this is going to happen, but you should realize, in other words, that the Torah is a text that is there to, you know, to not just to give laws, but also to teach lessons. And the lesson that is being given here is, if you do something like this, you actually deserve to lose your own eye if you do this to another human being. We're not going to do that. But you should know that if you do not pay the penalty, pay a ransom, a kofer, then you really deserve to lose your eye.
Hakatuv asar aleinu. Here's another
interesting textual argument. Hakatuv asar aleinu shelo nikach kofer lenefesh rotzeach asher hu rasha lamut. There's a verse that we just read in the parsha last week. You're not allowed to take ransom for the life of a murderer, an evil person who caused death. But that means, this is another argument that we see showing up in a lot of Jewish texts on this subject. For the situation of a murderer, you're not allowed to take a ransom, but you are allowed to take a ransom in a situation, another Rasha, the Rasha of the world Seach, you're not allowed to take a ransom, but you are allowed to take a ransom in the situation of somebody who wasn't a murderer. The problem with this, Ramban understands what the problem of this is. If you're saying you deserve to lose your eye, we're not going to take your eye from you, but we're going to tell you to pay. But then what happens if the person doesn't pay? One would, if this is a ransom that gets you off the hook, then you might say that,
okay, if he doesn't pay, then he has to lose his eye. And Rabban does not want that to be the answer.
And so he says, we take a ransom so that the person does not lose a limb if he caused another person to lose a limb. But actually, we never will cut off that limb from him. He is to pay monetary compensation for that limb. And if he has no money to pay, the debt remains on him until he acquires the means to pay. Because you might say that it means, okay, there's a ransom, but what if you don't have the ransom? And so if you say, I don't have the money, they say, okay, we're going to cut off your arm, we're going to cut off your leg. Yad tachat yad, regal tachat raga. Ramban doesn't want that. So you see Ramban here, like all of the traditional Jewish commentators, and like that lengthy Talmudic passage that I didn't share with you in Bava Kama, trying to find something, some way of reading the text as coming to the conclusion of Ayin Tachat
Ayin.
I'll just mention what you know, that I take a particular interest in Rashbam's
commentary on the Torah. Rashbam is
perhaps the commentator who is most dedicated to Pshat, and is willing to offer pshat interpretations of text, even if they don't go along with the halachic tradition. Here he just says, ayin tachat
ayin, to make ayin.
It means money. It means the monetary value of the eye. He does not, there really is no one in the standard rabbinic tradition who says anything else on the subject. But we'll see,
despite the fact that
there is no argument, internal arguments about this issue, there were a lot of interesting arguments about this text. Just share with you what Rav Yaakov C. Mecklenburg wrote about this in the Ktav Kabbalah. He writes, the commentators explain that the Torah records here only the punishment that the injuring party deserves to receive. When it says that which he did should be done to him, it means that he ought to be punished like that. Okay, so this is kind of similar to what Ramban said in the name of Ibn Ezra. This is what he deserved. Mecklenburg asks a great question. He said, this explanation is not sufficient to satisfy
truth seekers.
I love the Hebrew here. Lo yirvet zimaon dorshei emet. But here, somebody who really is interested in truth, you're not going to be totally satisfied with that answer. Ech paskir haTorah ha'anasha yara'u lachul alav v'talib mimenu b'mayyanesh be'emet. Why would the Torah tell you the punishment that he deserves to get, that the offender deserves to get, and wouldn't mention what the punishment is that the offender actually gets? It's a fine question, but it does I didn't love Mecklenburg's answer that much, and those of you who wish can look it up on your own, but I did like the way he phrased the question, that it is unusual to say that the Torah is telling you what this person deserves
as a punishment, but doesn't mention that which
The punishment that the person is going to receive.
I think that the essential question
that might underlie this issue that Mecklenburg is raising here is, like, what is a very important question, what is the purpose of the Torah? Is the Torah there to be providing a law code, or is the Torah there to be educating us? And if we say that the Torah is there to be educating us, then fine, okay, it's educating us.
Ayin tachat ayin, that somebody who does something like this.
This is what they deserve. Can we easily say that the Torah is there simply as a law code? From medieval times until the 21st century, many people would point out that the law code of the Torah doesn't work with a law as a law code unless one adds an awful lot to that law code. There's so many
aspects of it
that are missing, and so to say that it has the educational value might not be such a terrible thing to say. The verse ended up being part of a couple of very interesting polemics over the years. The first of the two polemics is the polemic between Karaites and Rabbanites.
Karaites,
just to review, Jews who do not accept the authority of rabbinic texts, and apparently medieval Karaites were arguing. We saw a dispute between Karaites and Rabbanites. Rabbanites means Jews who do accept the authority of the rabbis. We saw a dispute between Karaites and Rabbanites last week about the status of the fetus. And here we learn that the Karaites were actually suggesting that ayin
tachat ayin means literally. And
rabbis in the Middle Ages were trying to defend the traditional rabbinic understanding. The first rabbi we see on this subject is Rabbi Sadia Gaon, who even has a post who says, we cannot interpret this verse according to its plain meaning. Why? For if a person struck someone else's eye and the eye lost a third of its sight, how is it possible to punish the culprit with an equivalent blow, that is, with a blow which is neither greater nor lesser? You know, the ayin tachat ayin, if we strike somebody in the eye and you injure them, that does not necessarily mean that they are now down to zero sight. Now they might have less sight than they had before. And how would it be possible to do this? It's impossible.
You can't have a legal system that
does something like this. There's the possibility that the culprit will lose his entire eyesight. Burns, wounds, and bruises present even greater difficulties, Rav Sadia Gaon says, as quoted by Ibn Ezra, for if they are inflicted on a dangerous area, it is possible that the culprit will die. This would be intolerable. So if you burn somebody else, and then they say, okay, we're going to burn you, well, you might end up killing the person. I don't know, when you read this text, though, and when I read this, this reminds me of The Merchant of Venice. The question of whether it would be possible to take a pound of flesh without killing the person from whom one is taking a pound of flesh. So a number of years before Shakespeare, Rav Sadia Gaon is raising this issue. You can't really have a legal system that allows something like this, because it would be impossible to administer the legal system in a fair manner.
Ibn Ezra quotes
a Karaite about whom we don't know very much, by the name of Ben Zuta. He shows up in Rav Sadia's writings, and so presumably he's a contemporary of Rav Sadia back from the 10th century, and Ibn Ezra is, of course, in the 12th century. Some people think that the name Ben Zuta might just be a corruption of his name. Zuta is the Aramaic word for little guy, so that maybe his name was something else. There's a suggestion that his name might have been something else, and they just, the rabbinites who were making fun of him changed his name into Ben Zuta, that little guy there. Ben Zuta responded, Kasher asa, chenye asa lo, it says in Vayikra, that which the culprit did shall be done to him. The Gaon retorted, well, take a look. Samson said,
Asher asu li,
Cain asiti lahem. I think it's a nice strong argument from the book of Judges that when Samson says, Asher asu li, Cain asiti lahem, it does not mean that he did the same thing that they did to him. Samson did not take their wives and hand them over to others, which is what had been done by Samson's enemies. He took other steps to punish them for this. He only repaid them for their dastardly acts. So and it's a good, strong argument that Sadia Gaon is making, that even language like Kasher, Asu, Li, Kain, Asiti, Lahem does not necessarily have to mean literally an eye for an eye. And so when it says at the top of the slide here, Kasher Asa Kein Ye'asamo, based on the comparison to the Shimshon story, we know that that does not have to mean literally doing the same thing. Benzuta hishiv, im hayah hamakeh ani maya onsho. Benzuta answered, if the culprit is a poor man, what shall his punishment be? You're saying that it's impossible to administer the literal penalty, but sometimes it's impossible to administer the monetary penalty. The Gaon answered, if a blind person blinds someone who can see, what shall be done to him? That's a good question. If it says, ayin tachat ayin, if I'm blind and I blind somebody who isn't blind, what kind of penalty is going to be given to me? I'm already blind. For it is possible for a poor person to become wealthy and pay the monetary penalty, however, a blind person would never be able to offer compensation following Ben Zuta's understanding. So even Ezra says that in the long run, it's easier to administer the monetary interpretation than to administer the literal interpretation. So that's like the description here that Ibn Ezra presents to us of an argument that Sadia had a number of years before him about this issue. And then Ibn Ezra finishes off by saying what he says frequently in his Korah commentary. The general rule is we cannot fully explain any commandment in the Torah unless we rely on the oral Torah. Just as we received the written Torah from our ancestors, so did we receive the oral Torah. There is no difference between them. Ibn Ezra consistently says that the Torah is written in such a way that it can't be put into effect without an oral Torah. One of Ibn Ezra's favorite arguments comes from the calendar. That, it says that on the 10th day of the 7th month, you must afflict yourself on Yom Kippur, but the Torah never tells you how to establish a calendar, how to figure out the length of a month, how many months there are in the year even, and none of this is in the Torah, and so it's obvious that the Torah did not come as a standalone document. And so the attempt of Karaites to turn the Torah into a standalone document is doomed to failure. Okay, this is in the history of polemics about biblical texts. This is polemic number one related to ayin tachat ayin, related to an eye for an eye. The more contemporary and more troubling in many senses polemic about an eye for an eye is part of the way in which an eye for an eye shows up in Jewish Christian polemics over the years. It shows up in
an eye for an eye shows up in the
Sermon on the Mount. And just assuming that most people, but not everybody who's here today, know about the context of the Sermon on the Mount in Matthew chapter 5, Jesus is quoted as saying in the Sermon on the Mount, "Do not think that I have come to abolish the law or the prophets. I have not come to abolish them, but to fulfill them. For truly I tell you, until heaven and earth disappear, not the smallest letter, not the least stroke of a pen will by any means disappear from the law until everything is accomplished." And the law, it's clear it means here the Torah. It's saying that I have not come to get rid of anything from the Torah. Not the smallest letter, not the least stroke of a pen. In the old King James translation, it says not a jot and not a tittle. And presumably in the original, it says kotzo shel yud. In this speech, even a tiny part of the letter yud, nothing is going to disappear from the law. Therefore, anyone who sets aside any one of the least of these commands and teaches others accordingly will be called least in the kingdom of heaven. But whoever practices and teaches these commands will be called great in the kingdom of heaven. For I tell you that unless your righteousness surpasses that of the Pharisees and the teachers of the law, you will certainly not enter the kingdom of heaven. I'm not here to get rid of anything from the Torah. I'm here to tell you that you have to do more than the rabbinic teachers that are alive here in Eretz Yisrael in the first century are telling you to do. Your righteousness has to be greater than the righteousness of the Pharisees and the teachers of the law. That's the introduction to the way in which Jesus is reported by Matthew to be explaining the way in which his message differs from the standard rabbinic message of the time. And then in the continuation of the sermon, there are various examples of the difference between what is being portrayed as Jesus' morality and the morality of the rabbis. It's a very difficult text for anybody who knows anything that's going on in the first century. So first of all,
Matthew, this is a shocking kind of statement here that Jesus is not interested in getting rid of
anything from the law. But putting that aside, just looking at the situation and seeing what are, I gave you here three of his examples. "You have heard that it was said, you shall not commit adultery. But I tell you that anyone who looks at a woman lustfully has already committed adultery with her in his heart." Some of you might recognize this quotation from an interview with Jimmy Carter in Playboy magazine. I looked up to see when it was. It was back in November 1976. Some of you who are as old as me might remember.
I did not read it in
Playboy magazine, but this was reported all over the media that Carter gave an interview to Playboy magazine, and he was asked, "Have you ever committed adultery?" And he said, "No, I have never committed adultery, but I have committed adultery in my heart. Many times I have looked lustfully at women other than my wife." So
these two verses here are saying it's not enough to refrain from committing adultery. You also shouldn't be
looking lustfully at another woman. Could this really be suggesting that the rabbis were going around teaching in those days that it's okay to look lustfully at women? No,
that's not possible. Anybody
who has studied any rabbinic literature knows that that's not what the rabbis were teaching. And there's a whole book published called The Jewish Sources of the Sermon on the Mount that tries to point out that shows, you know, parallels between almost everything that is being described here as the teaching of Jesus and the teachings of the rabbis. There's a line in the Talmud about kol hamispakel by etzbak tanan shel isha, even looking at the baby finger of a woman that you're not married to. It's hard to figure out what actually is being said here. Is the different is being portrayed as the difference between the position that's being attributed here to the Pharisees and the teachers of the law, which are the rabbis, essentially, of the first century, and what is being attributed to being Jesus' position. The second example here is probably the clearest example. It has been said, anyone who divorces his wife must give her a certificate of divorce, but I tell you that anyone who divorces his wife except for sexual immorality makes her the victim of adultery, and anyone who marries a divorced woman commits adultery. You can't find a parallel to this in classical rabbinic texts. So this is a teaching being attributed to Jesus that is definitely at odds with the teachings of the rabbis. Are the rabbis fans of divorce? No, the rabbis are not fans of the of divorce. And then the other passages of classical rabbinic literature that talk about the mizbeach, the altar in the temple, crying whenever a couple gets a divorce. But this radical formulation here, that if there is a divorce, and the woman remarries, then she is committing adultery, and the man who marries a woman who is divorced is also committing adultery. You can't find any parallel to that in rabbinic law. So the first example here, you shall not commit adultery, is Jesus being portrayed here as agreeing with that. Yes, he's portrayed as agreeing with it, but he's saying, but you have to go beyond that. Okay. The second one, that a divorce can be effected by giving a bill of divorce, a certificate of divorce. It looks like he's disagreeing with that, or he's at least modifying it considerably. Although, if you look at the phrase here, except for sexual immorality, you can find an opinion in rabbinic literature that the only legitimate grounds for divorce is sexual immorality. So it's not totally clear that this is all that different from everything being taught by the rabbis. But then you get to, there are many other examples. I just wanted to give you three to get a flavor of what's happening here. You have heard that it was said, eye for an eye and tooth for a tooth. But I tell you, do not resist an evil person. If anyone slaps you on the right cheek, turn to them the other cheek also. To turn the other cheek. And so this text is portraying Jesus as saying, those rabbis out there teach,
ayin tachat ayin, shame tachat shame, but I tell you that if somebody slaps you,
just turn the other cheek. We have no evidence that anybody was teaching that in the first century in Eretz Yisrael. And the idea of turning the other cheek, incidentally, you know, it shows up a few places in the Hebrew Bible also, in what the Christians call the Old Testament. I offered my back to the floggers and my cheeks to those who tore out my hair. I did not hide my face from insight and from insult and spittle. Gevi natate lemakim, and towards the end of Yeshayahu, and you know, a reference to a text that we'll be reading very soon for Tisha B'Av. Tov lagever ki yisa ol binurav. It's good for a man binurav. It's good for a man when young to bear a yoke. Let him sit alone and be patient. When he has laid it upon him, let him put his mouth to the dust. There may yet be hope. Let him offer his cheek to the smiter. Yiten lemakehu lechi. Yisba becherpa. Let him be surfeited with mockery. This text is saying that there are times when you do offer your cheek to the person who is hitting you. So it's not all that clear what is new in the teaching that is being attributed here to Jesus, who says, they're teaching you an eye for an eye, but I tell you that if they slap you on the right cheek, turn the other cheek to them so they can slap you on your left cheek also. Despite the fact that historically speaking, we can't really figure out what is that this text is talking about. What is the what is different here between what the teaching that's being attributed to Jesus, that the rabbis are also teaching, you know, to be calm and meek and not to fight back against every time that you are insulted, and they're following in the tradition of the Hebrew Bible. Despite all of this, I think we all know that what happened in history is that people generally saw Christians generally saw the difference between Christian morality and Jewish morality, that Christian morality does not teach an eye for an eye, and that Jewish morality does teach an eye for an eye. You could also argue that this is underlying a text like the Merchant of Venice, what Shylock wants more than anything is vengeance, and Portia is trying to teach him that the quality of mercy is not screened, and at the end of the text, when Shylock converts to Christianity, that's what turns the text into a comedy, into a happy ending, that Shylock has realized that vengeance is not the way to go. So this became a crucial claim that the Jews had to deal with in many periods of history, the argument that Judaism is a religion of an eye for an eye. I just wanted to give you one example from the 21st century. This is from NGO Monitor, writing about Human Rights Watch. During the 2014 Gaza War, Director Ken Roth of Human Rights Watch obsessively tweeted about the conflict. Roth's tweets were characterized by significant levels of sarcasm, vitriol, and deep-seated hostility towards Israel. In July 2006, in responding to a critique of Human Rights Watch's reporting of the Lebanon War, Roth stated, "An eye for an eye, or more accurately in this case, 20 eyes for an eye, may have been the morality of some more primitive moment, that it is not the morality of international humanitarian law." So here is somebody, I doubt if this is actually somebody who is such a, I don't know very much about this Ken Roth, but I doubt if he is necessarily reflecting deep-seated religious feelings, but he's been influenced by Western values of saying that, you know, there is a religion out there, a primitive religion out there that teaches about an eye for an eye. And this text here from NGO Monitor finishes, "The New York Sun decried this statement as a slur on the Jewish religion itself that is breathtaking in its ignorance. To suggest that Judaism is a primitive religion incompatible with contemporary morality is to engage in supersessionism, the delegitimation of Judaism, the basis of much anti-Semitism." I don't often quote the New York Sun, but this is right on here, what they're saying here. This is supersessionism. Supersessionism is the idea that the Judaism has been superseded by Christianity. The Christianity is the improved version of the message from God, and no one ought to be following the old-fashioned message from God. And supersessionism often leads to anti-Semitism, and so we see that this, if you just go on the web and look up an eye for an eye, you'll find other texts where Jews are being criticized for being proponents of an eye for an eye. Beno Jacob was a very interesting Reform rabbi, born in Eastern Europe, lived much of his life in Germany, and ended up in England. And he wrote an entire book about an eye for an eye. Auge um Auge, eine Untersuchung zum alten und neuen Testamentum. An eye for an eye, a study of the Old and the New Testament, in which he tried to argue that Judaism has been maligned over the years because of this line, an eye for an eye, and people have not understood the line properly. And my German is weak. Part of Benno Jacob's argument, Benno Jacob received in Orthodox circles a big boost from the writings of Nechama Leibovich, because she quotes him all the time. He was a brilliant Bible commentator, and in a memorial volume to Nechama Leibovich, there is a letter that she received in which she was criticized from quoting from a Reform rabbi. And she said, you know what people say, beginning with the Rambam, Shmaha Emet Mipi Omrai, if somebody comes up with a good interpretation of the text. It's funny, Benno Jacob was this really interesting combination of liberalism and conservatism. Among Reform rabbis, Benno Jacob was part of the minority of Reform rabbis who supported moving Shabbat from Saturday to Sunday to make it easier for Jews living in European countries, where, as we know, a couple of generations ago, people were expected, if you were living in Canada or the United States or Western European countries, people were expected to go to work on Saturday. So Benno Jacob was when it came to halakha, he was not a traditionalist, but when it came to interpretation of the text, he was a very big fan of the traditional Jewish interpretive tradition. I have not read this book. He also wrote a commentary on Exodus, and parts of it were translated into English, and I've read that part. But I found here in this essay on the web a little bit of a summary of some of the arguments that Benno Jacob made on this issue. And Benno Jacob's work in this area in Germany. So he was writing about this. He was writing about Ein Tachat Ein as Nazism was growing in Germany. Benno Jacob's work on this area in Germany combined biblical studies and the struggle against anti-Semitism, arguing that the biblical requirement of an eye for an eye did not demand a literal talion. Talion is, lex talionis means the law of the talion, the law of retaliation, the law of recompense, the law that says that an eye for an eye is literal. That's the fancy Latin name for that is lex talionis, the law of the talion. Misconstrued by those demeaning Judaism, but rather indicated the payment of damages. And then Jacob begins his argument with a proof from the laws of Hammurabi, in a funny kind of way. Jacob compares the Old Testament law with the Talionic laws found in the Code of Hammurabi, and he argues that the Torah had left the primitive world far behind. Jacob argues that the biblical formulation in the Old Testament does not fit the explicit nature of a literal classical formulation of the talion. In the Code of Hammurabi, true talion was expressed in an unmistakable linguistic form. This, rather than the biblical statement, is the classical formulation of talion. The judicial punishment had to use the same words as used for the crime. So Benno Jacob says, you look in the Code of Hammurabi, this is how, if you want to write the law of Tally, and this is how you write it. If a man knock out the teeth of his equal, his teeth shall be knocked out. And using the same noun and the same verb. So it's a stylistic argument. He's beginning with a stylistic argument here against the against the literal understanding of what it says in the Bible. He says if the Bible really wanted to get across the law of Tali, and it would have to phrase it differently. We see that from the Code of Hammurabi that does phrase it in this way. I just wanted to say that I try to avoid using Old Testament. I don't like calling the Bible the Old Testament. When I'm quoting from a book that uses the word Old Testament, I quote from it accurately. Finally, this is David still writing on the subject. Jacob decries that the first gospel and its Sermon on the Mount had been used unjustly against Judaism and the Torah, both of which were explicitly against revenge. So this essay makes it clear that what Beno Jacob was doing was partially biblical interpretation, and it was partially the defense of Judaism against the accusation that Judaism is a bloodthirsty kind of religion that is based on the idea of an eye for an eye. So when we look at the history of the way this was interpreted, the Karaites were saying to the Rabbinites,
you're interpreting this wrong, you have to be
taking this literally, there's what the text says. And the Christians, not all Christians, some Christians were saying to the Jews, yes, you guys interpret this literally. The defenders of Judaism, starting with Rav Sadia Gaon and continuing into later generations, had to fight in two different directions on the subject. I have more to say on the subject. I don't have enough time left. I'm going to leave Rambam for our next session. And Shadal, I'll leave for our next session, but maybe I'll just finish off with a quotation here that I like from an essay by Ahad Ha'am, Asher Ginsberg, the great Zionist thinker, wrote an essay called Torah Shebalev. If you want to read it, just go to a Google window and write in Hebrew, Achad Ha'am Torah Shebalev, and you can read his essay. Finish off here today with this, the way Achad Ha'am understands, portrays what happened in Jewish history. You can either agree or disagree with Achad Ha'am, but I thought it was very nice. When the human heart reached the stage of development that it realized with certainty that an eye for an eye is a type of cruelty that is inappropriate for a cultured nation. And at that point in history, the feelings of the heart were considered a supreme authority. You look over on the Hebrew side, when Haran was writing this essay, there still isn't a word for authority in Hebrew. So he writes, Bo'tasha of Koripat She'en Lamala Mimena. The people started to feel the compassionate feelings that they have in their heart are, you know, like they're part of the Torah. That they come from God. God is making me compassionate. God has caused us all that when we look at something like
an eye for an eye, we immediately say,
no, that couldn't be that. We're not willing to see that. So it's just when the nation reached that stage where that's what people really felt. And at that point, the feelings of the heart were considered a supreme authority. Then it became clear that the other authority, the written word, simply could not be saying anything different. And thus, there is no doubt that an eye for an eye means money. Biblical interpretation is influenced by the feelings that we have.
And the moral outlook that we have is what Ahad Ha'am is arguing here.
That once people reached this conclusion, once Jews reached this conclusion in the course of Jewish history, then it became very clear that you look at those words in the text, and those words have to mean money. And
that's why
there are two pages in the Gemara in Bava Kamma trying to find proofs from the text when it's clear that the Gemara is just beginning from the assumption it couldn't be literal. And Acharam is arguing, as opposed to somebody like Ibn Ezra, who was arguing before that this is from the Torah Sheba'al Peh. That's the more traditional way of saying the Torah Sheba'al Peh. And we'll see, we'll look at Rambam a little bit in the next session, reminding everyone that's 2 weeks from now. We'll start with by finishing off this topic of an eye for an eye 2 weeks from now. Instead of saying that it comes from the Torah Sheba'al Peh, Acharam wants to say that it comes from the heart, it comes from the feelings of compassion that are normal for human beings to have, and the biblical interpretation is influenced by those feelings.
Okay, I'm going to stop sharing the screen here, and I'm going to take a look at
the questions that showed up here in the chat. Iran has just sentenced a number of people to having their eyes gouged out for having caused other individuals to lose use of an eye. Wonderful. Thank you for telling us.
Why not the guilty
person saving himself as a slave to pay ransom? Maybe that was done at various periods in history. It's not a bad suggestion that could be how that was handled in various situations. Linda writes, Matthew sounds like the more Saul of his time, maybe a
sarcastic stand-up comic commentator
on Jewish law. It really does seem to be, I agree with you, Linda, that it seems to be an attack on Jewish law that isn't an accurate attack on Jewish law. Okay, so I'm sorry that somebody had problems with their audio. An eye for an eye, Miriam or John Bloomberg said, is the basis for a legal system for bodily honor versus turn the other cheek, is talking about individual retribution.
Yeah, okay, so it's possible. That's right. I totally agree that in that passage in Matthew, what might be happening is that that there's a suggestion that an eye for an eye is not as a legal principle, but it's as the way we should relate to another human being. That if somebody does something bad to me, I should pay them back. And
you can't find in Jewish texts that anybody actually interpreted an eye for an eye in that way in the rabbinic tradition. But I totally agree that that's when you look at that passage there in Matthew, you get that idea that he's not talking about an eye for an eye as being what a court is doing, but what the individual is doing. Okay, sorry to hear a number of people are having trouble with the audio.
What did Fada Amid, sadly the most cultured nation in Europe, listen to emotional appeals from their fascist fear and rewrote the book on what is acceptable? Phil, 100%. Writing before World War II, a lot of great Jewish thinkers writing before World War II had a lot of belief that the world was getting to be a much better world. Even Rav Kook, who died in 1935, you can see his belief in progress. And there's a famous passage in Rav Kook where Rabbi Yitzhak Cohen Kook, the first Ashkenazi chief rabbi of modern Israel, where he says that the reason why God arranged that the Jews would kind of be out of history for a period of time and then would come back into history in coming back to their land and being like another normal people in the 20th century is because the world has advanced in such a way that now it is possible to set up a country without the need
for any fighting or things like this, because the more you see Rav Kook really buying into drinking the Kool-Aid of that the world is so much better. And, you know, we have the benefit. We look at Achad Ha'am and we look at Rav Kook and we think about what happened after they died in what was considered to be the most cultured land in the in Europe. And it's hard to accept everything that they said. Is the Rabbanut listening? So if you look at the continuation of Achad Ha'am's essay, which I decided that I did not want to read together, but in the continuation of Achad Ha'am's essay, he argues, but they don't do that anymore. Back then in Talmudic times, they were really good at doing things like that, but Achad Ha'am goes into a tirade against the against contemporary rabbis. If you want to read a tirade against the contemporary rabbis from the beginning of the 20th century, you could go and read that essay of Achad Ha'am. Justin writes, if every upshot of interpretation deviates from a presumed pshat, does this perhaps point to there not, in fact, being a pshat? How might this affect other legal renderings? Excellent question, Justin. That is the kind of postmodern approach, that there is no such thing as the pshat, that there are simply ways in which you read the text, ways in which I read the text, and as long as you do it with good faith, that's what the postmodernists say, that any reading that is based on good faith is fine. I think I may have quoted one time, I was at an academic conference, and I heard somebody who subscribes to postmodernism saying one time, I hear a lot of people saying the text says, you know, I put my ear right beside the text and I listen to the text, and you know, the text doesn't actually say anything to me. But
I am
the one who reads the text. The text isn't saying. And so
that is
a common intellectual position that I don't want to dismiss it. I don't want to live that way of saying that there is no pshat. But I totally understand what you are suggesting. Okay. If somebody says this.
Sound is dependent on where I sit. I've been trying not to move
around as much as I sometimes do. And I'm actually sitting on a chair that doesn't have any wheels, so I won't. But I guess I do still move a little. I'll see if I can put myself in a straitjacket next time. What does it say about people of societies that are willing to be literal? Literalism can be a problem of a lot of things, and the ability to come up with new interpretations of texts is a very important ability, and it's the way in which society progresses. We all know about disputes about Supreme Courts in Canada and in the United States and in Israel, the question of, you know, coming up with new interpretations of laws, about the legitimacy of doing that. But I think that it clearly there's a limit to it, but if there are no interpretations, if interpretation stays the same all through the years, Rashman uses the phrase "hapshatot hamitchadshim b'chol yom," the pshat interpretations that are newly thought of on every day. So Rashman, who's I just want the pshat, he does understand that our understanding of pshat changes over time. Okay,
Can I ask you a question?
Sure, go ahead.
We've been talking about Judaism and, you know, how we interpret more kindly. I'm finding the Talmud, where we're talking about our Judaism, that rape, does not seem to bother our rabbis as much as lineage does. And if we're talking about how understanding we are, I really find that we're not very understanding where women come into play.
You're raising a really important and very large issue, which I'm not going to solve, and in fact, not going to address right now. But it is a big question, and I would say that the attitudes towards towards women have evolved. They have not evolved at the speed with which they have evolved in general society, and
I'm not happy
about the speed at which they evolved, but that they have changed over the years. And there's a very good book written about this by Rabbi Eliezer Berkowitz called Jewish Women in Time and Torah, in which he tries to separate between the essential Torah attitudes toward women and various attitudes that crept into our texts from general society. Okay, we're not going to solve that today, but thank you for raising it. And I will see you 2 weeks from today. I think we're going to stop here. We're a few minutes over the hour, and I have to move on, but I'll see you 2 weeks from now.
Thank you. Just if I say two things. First of all, the sound, I don't know what it was like on the prior weeks. I wasn't here, but you're right. It did go in and out. I'm not sure it had to do where you're seating or something. We could hear sometimes it got louder, though. I don't know what the issue was. But something, maybe people have been here every week. Was this ever a problem before? Is this unique?
Yes.
It's been ongoing, and I think it's getting worse.
Ongoing.
Okay. So I wish somebody would have told. Okay, fine. Okay, so I assume it's something on your end, Dr. Lakshin. I don't know what exactly.
Okay, I'll see if I might be able before 2 weeks from now to come up with something.
Yeah, I mean, everything was clear. It just, I think, it just sometimes it was sort of a little louder, sometimes a little more echoed.
Okay.
Anyways, okay, so I apologize for that. Everybody, it's good. People don't complain too much because nobody let me know. But okay, you can complain. It's okay, we like getting complaints as long as they are constructive. Number two, I'll
Rabbi
just
J, say, Rabbi J.
Hold on 1 second. I just want to say one thing. I'll take a comment on the woman's issue. Yes, it's a huge issue, but I think the change is enormous. If you think back 40, 50 years, I think yes, it may not be as fast as some people would like it. It's unbelievable what we have today. We have women. Almost poskot, woman talmidot chachamot giving shirim. We have women Orthodox rabbis. Yes, some people don't accept it, do accept it. But the fact that we have a discussion about this, and by the way, the Lehrhaus article we referenced at the beginning talks about Rabbi Melamed's complicated, complex position on women. On the one hand, he believes in a very traditional approach. On the other hand, he'll say we can allow birth control before no kids so a woman can pursue her educational dreams, you know, wants to finish medical school before having kids. So it's sort of, you know, he takes great weight in women's profession and women leadership. It's, I think in one generation, the change has been enormous, probably faster than any other change I can think of in a sociological area in history. Correct me if I'm wrong, but anybody, but that's that. Okay. Also, just one important announcement. I have to send an email. Dr. Sokolow emailed, he has a conflict tomorrow. So Dr. Sokolow's class is also pushed off. He's not going to be giving class tomorrow. Tomorrow night, Shoshana Shachter will be giving the Parshat HaShavua Shir from, I think, the associate dean at Stern, or the director of Jewish Studies. I don't remember exact title, but she's up in Stern. She taught last year, teaching in various, you know, Jewish studies program. Then my shir on the Siddur Friday. And of course, like I mentioned, the Sunday program on Tisha B'Av, which again, just a reminder, you do have to register, you know, separately. It's not part of the summer schedule. It's sort of a separate, you know, program, if I can say that. It's really, please God, listen, we'll keep eight hours straight of learning. Anybody who comes all day, we send them lunch at 7. An hour before I think you get a heter to end the fast early. If you come from 11 to 7, especially if you live in Israel, you get a heter to end the fast a lot earlier. Anyways, okay, everybody. And I think that's it pretty much. And then Monday, Naomi Seidman, her class in Beis Yaakov, really her first class, the series she'll be giving on women and gender, actually, in Beis Yaakov. So she'll be taking the next 2 weeks on Monday at 1 p.m. All right, everybody.
So Rabbi Jay,
about Dr. Lakshin, you can leave. I don't want to keep you too long. So you can
leave. Okay, thank you very much. All the best.
Thank you.
Rabbi Jay, about the voice, the sounds, when Dr. Lakshin got closer to the computer or further, then it's changed.
Yeah, the question is, that doesn't normally happen. Like when I speak or other people speak, I don't think that normally happens, but I don't know.
It happened at three classes.
Okay. So I, if that's the issue, maybe that is the issue. So we'll have to, put a rope around them. Okay.
Thank you very much.
But it's hard to sit still when you teach. Anybody will tell you that.
Okay.
All right. Very good. Bye-bye. Everybody have a wonderful day. Okay. Thank you. Bye-bye. Bye.